Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, do you hear the people sing? I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be looking into some excellent retrofuturism.
Yeah. Yes, the future of the past.
We've done this a couple times.
The past of the future.
Yeah.
What the past thought about the future. There you go.
There we go.
Do you remember those times when we looked at the advertisements for the kitchen of tomorrow from the 1950s where they thought we would have giant, you know, multi-refrigerator-sized machines that would automatically make meals for us that looked about the quality of a microwavable dinner.
I remember the heavy dose of misogyny that went along with those advertisements, yes.
Well, of course, it's assumed that the woman would still stay in the kitchen in the future because that's where she lives.
That was right, yeah. So she didn't have to cook anymore, but she was still in the kitchen all day.
All the time, yeah. But it appeared that she was also probably on like a lot of Valium, so she probably didn't mind.
The nice thing is today we're going to talk about something much less offensive, the use of nuclear weapons. Yeah.
This episode, you guys, this is great.
So this was something that, before we even get into it, I was on Reddit and I jumped into the futurism, subreddit. And one of the things someone shared was a video. It was an old, film from the 60s about a government program called, Project Plowshare. And I had somehow never really heard of this. And I'm amazed I've never heard of it.
Because it's terrific, like in the grammatical sense of the word. Yes. Like it inspires terror and also awe.
Yeah.
So this film was put out by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission circa 1965. And it's you know, the full-on 1960s drama, you know, with all the really great music and all of the really great narration.
I loved how peppy it was, and it's talking about using nuclear bombs to essentially make really big holes on purpose for
because it's so much better. It's so much better than traditional explosives at making holes.
Yeah, it's really good at that.
Yes. So if you do want to watch this, then you should. It's really great. It's labeled as being from 1961, but I think that's inaccurate because in the film itself, they reference events up to 1964. So at any rate, though, you can Google it.
It's on the YouTubes.
Yeah.
And, there's in a couple of different locations. Also, there's an entire report about Plowshare that's available on the Department of Energy's website. So you can actually go, you can read about all the different tests they did. But before we get into what it was specifically and how it came about, they're going to backtrack just a bit and talk about the events that led up to Project Plowshare becoming a thing.
Because the question that I'm sure many of you, like we asked, is why would anyone decide that it was a good idea to try to use nuclear bombs to do stuff?
It sounds like something that would come to mind if you had a bunch of extra nuclear bombs lying around and you were trying to figure out what to do with them.
It's not like it's kale. It's not like, oh man, I didn't use all this kale. Yeah.
Still, Joe is pretty right. But to me, it sounds like the sort of thing that you would suggest before you had a full understanding of the implications of nuclear weaponry. But that's not the case. This was well after we understood at least a good amount about what nuclear weapons were capable of.
Oh, yeah.
So during World War II, I'm sure everyone who's listening to this is aware of the Manhattan Project, which was an R&D operation that the U.S. government oversaw to develop atomic weaponry. And this was of very high importance to the U.S. government because everyone knew that other world powers were also working on this. Specifically, the Germans early on were working on this. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some of the scientists we had working on the Manhattan Project were originally over in Germany, but then we got them and brought them here, and then they worked for us.
Well, they defected.
Some of them did.
Well,
some of them were more, let's say, pragmatic. Right? Like they were working for one government in order to advance science. And then another government came along and said, you're with us now. And they said, well, as long as I get to do the science, I will continue to do so.
I wonder if some of them just kind of saw that the tides were turning and said,
hey, this other
time
place.
To get out of here.
This other place sounds like a better place.
To be fair, it was tough being a physicist in Germany during World War II.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We've talked, I can't remember whether it was on this show or on Tech Stuff, uh-huh. about some of the really deep, personal, impossible to retroactively suss out reasons that people had, that scientists had for getting out of Germany.
Yeah, yeah, no. Of course, there were Jewish scientists who wished to defect early on. There were other scientists who were not Jewish, but who sympathized mm-hmm. with their Jewish counterparts and found themselves in a very delicate position because on the one hand, they didn't want to have to pick up everything and leave. But on the other hand, they very much objected to what was going on. At any rate, the United States, their program, the Manhattan Project, was successful before anyone else was able to develop a working atomic weapon. And once the bomb was developed, it was obviously put to devastating effect. And shortly after the conclusion of World War II, we entered into the atomic age, the nuclear age, where we got into the Cold War between the United States mm-hmm. and the then Soviet Union.
Right.
And both countries began to build and stockpile nuclear weapons. And it was this idea of mutually assured destruction, the idea that if both parties had massive stockpiles of weapons, no one would dare use it because to do so would be pure madness. That's a philosophy that no one really wants to put to the test, right?
Well, putting it to the test would sort of defeat it, right? It would prove it wrong.
It gets into Dr. Strangelove territory, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So during this time of tension in the Cold War, which some of us in this room are old enough to remember what it was like, I'm assuming
I was alive then. I remember a little bit of that. Like, I remember when it was over and not really understanding fully why all of my, you know, grown-ups were so emotional about it.
Right.
But, you know, but I remember it.
Did the Soviet Union still exist when the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie came out?
Oh, the first movie? Yeah. I don't think so. Was that like 91? Anyway, this is a tangent.
Well,
okay.
At any rate, yeah, I remember from the Reagan years specifically how there was still a very anti-Russian kind of right. mentality in a lot of U.S. culture. So this was something that was deeply ingrained in the U.S. and presumably in the Soviet Union. Or the then Soviet Union, I should mm-hmm. say. So one of the things that came up during this process of building up this stockpile of weapons was an idea of what if we could utilize nuclear explosions, not as weaponry, not as a bomb, but as a tool. So we've used explosives as tools for ages.
Sure. Drilling, tunneling. Well, I guess not drilling. Well, I guess sort of in aid of drilling.
Yeah.
Tunneling, well, excavation. Mining, excavation.
Sure. And so the thought was, well, these nuclear explosions have potentially thousands of times the power or even more than conventional high explosives. So if you could figure out a way of channeling that properly, then you could find peaceful uses for this technology and do much more work on a much faster scale than you would using older methods. From that perspective, you could say, all right, well, that makes sense. But there are some other big questions we have to answer. Things like, what do you do about fallout and stuff like that? So early on, back in 1953, so not that long after the conclusion of World War II, President Dwight Eisenhower actually proposed looking into that sort of use for nuclear technology, not just nuclear explosions, but nuclear technology in general. And he called his idea Atoms for Peace.
Okay, but wouldn't this include just standard nuclear power?
That was
nuclear fission reactors of the kind we have today?
Yeah, exactly. Because he was thinking, well, you know, we've demonstrated that splitting an atom results in the release of a massive amount of energy. If we can do a controlled version of that as opposed to a release of that energy, if we could channel that energy somehow, then that would be a great boon for mankind. And so
the way you said that made it sound kind of like it was Eisenhower's idea to use fission power.
No, he was simply his idea.
The champion of it in the
political implementation.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes.
I'm sure without scientists designing the reactor.
Dwight might have been sitting around one day going like, hey, you guys.
The point being that without the political, there is no movement. Because there's no money.
Very good point.
So the Atomic Energy Commission ended up taking over this idea. Now, the Atomic Energy Commission would later, would dissolve back in 1975. It would be eventually be replaced by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Energy Research and Development Administration, and then later still the Department of Energy. And then you also had another party that was involved in this, the University of California Radiation Laboratory, which today we call the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory.
Oh, man, the Radiation Laboratory is a good name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why give that up?
Well, gosh, I can't imagine. So they got together and launched this new program, the Plowshare Program, on June 19th, 1957. The Radiation Laboratory was in charge of administering the program. The Atomic Energy Commission was in charge of making sure they could fund the program, so that they were the department that the money came from. So probably the most notable personality attached to this was Dr. Edward Teller.
Ah, the father of the bomb, right?
Fusion bomb. Yeah. Yeah. Specifically the fusion bomb. He hated that term, from what I understand. He did not like being called the father of the fusion bomb, which I guess made everyone call him that even more. Or father of the hydrogen bomb is also the way that it has been worded. So
right. The distinction there being between the hydrogen fusion bomb and the types of atomic bombs we dropped in World War II.
Yes, which were fission, not fusion. So the operation actually takes its name, Plowshare, from a biblical verse, Isaiah chapter 2, verse 4.
May I read it?
You may.
Ah, it is that they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up their sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore.
Yeah, a lovely sentiment.
Yeah.
Yes.
Turning the weapons of war into tools of agriculture and peaceful use.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is exactly what the outspoken philosophy of Plowshare was. You could argue that perhaps the motivations weren't quite so altruistic.
In the Cold War, was any stated motivation the actual motivation?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this with the space race, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the space race was largely, in fact, primarily fueled by the Cold War.
Oh, right, right, because it was all about, like, hey, guys, check out these really big rockets.
Yeah.
Like, we could use these really big rockets to go to the moon or bomb the crap out of your country.
Yeah, it's essentially what was going on. Now, granted, scientists were taking advantage of that situation in order to advance our knowledge, and we're very thankful for it. It's unfortunate that the Cold War was the factor that actually got literally the space race off the ground. But at any rate, same thing here.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things that people have pointed out is that Operation Plowshare would allow for national security measures to be strengthened by saying, look at all these other countries that are trying to rush toward developing nuclear technology. Mm-hmm. Because by the 1960s, you had several nations that had developed at least some level of nuclear power, including China. So the USSR and China being two nations that the US was not terribly comfortable having as nuclear power peers. There was a worry that other nations would also rush to develop this technology, and many of the nations stated officially that their interest in nuclear technology wasn't in nuclear weapons, but rather to use nuclear power in positive ways. And so the U.S. folks in Plowshare said, hey, if we create a program where we can put nuclear explosions to peaceful use, and we control those nuclear devices, and we essentially allow other countries to make use of that technology with our supervision, they don't have to go out and develop it themselves.
Making ourselves sort of the gatekeepers of nuclear technology.
Very much so. So, you know, the way I worded this in our notes in a kind of snarky way was like the U.S. saying, oh, you want a bomb so that you can make a canal? Well, it just so happens we can do that for you. We just hold on to the keys for the bomb. How about we'll hold on to those. And you just show us where you want the canal to go. And so, you know, I don't know how sincere the actual stated motto of Plowshare was. However, I know that there were plenty of people working earnestly to try and find real practical ways to use nuclear explosions in peaceful applications. So it's not like everyone there was snidely whiplash secretly working on an evil scheme. That's not the case at all.
Sure, there was probably minimal mustache twirling.
Probably.
At least on the science level.
Yeah.
Well, I'd imagine the threat of nuclear war made everybody a little crazy.
Yeah.
Definitely.
There were certain days when I was just not having any of it, Joe. I'm just going to tell you. 7-year-old me, very little tolerance for the threat of nuclear annihilation.
I know, right? Man. Okay, so what are some of these scientific proposals for how we can peacefully use nuclear weapons? So,
I've got one. Uh-huh. How about in cooking? You know, like industrial cooking, like we really need to cook a whole bunch of chickens at once to make a bunch of Stouffer's dinners.
No, totally. I mean, you know, this is like, you know, your Thanksgiving, you're around Thanksgiving, you're a restaurant that does catering. You've got like 140 birds to cook.
Uh-huh.
Come on, man.
I've got an even better example for you.
Uh-huh.
Refrigerator delivery, as seen in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
You gotta
deliver a refrigerator by air.
That which you dare not speak its name.
All right. So, all joking aside and painful memories of terrible franchise entries, we can talk about, some actual projects that were underneath Project Plowshare.
Well, we already mentioned basically digging.
Yeah. And excavation was originally thought of as the most promising of all the potential uses. It certainly was viewed as the one that would be likely to be the most beneficial, the quickest, meaning that, you know, we already knew that an explosion could move a lot of Earth. So, and we already had used high explosives to do this. So presumably it would not be that difficult to figure out a way to use nuclear explosions to do a similar thing. However, the project started to encounter problems other than the technical variety. An early example was a project called Project Chariot, which was supposed to take place in Alaska near an area called Cape Thompson. The site was at the mouth of a body of water, the Ogotoric Creek, and it was about 30 miles from a village called Point Hope. It was an Inupiat Eskimo village, and I apologize for completely butchering pronunciation, by the way. But it included land that had previously been requested by the natives under the Alaska Native Allotment Act. So it was already something that was going to run into problems even without the nuclear part of this issue. In the summer of 1958, Native Eskimos heard rumors that the Atomic Energy Commission planned to detonate a 2.4 megaton nuclear bomb, which is a bomb that would be 100 times more powerful than the one that was dropped on Hiroshima. And it was scheduled for detonation in 1962 if they were to stay on schedule. The reason for it being pushed back to 62 was that there was going to be a lot of construction that would be required up to the point of detonating this bomb. And the whole purpose of it was to dig out a harbor off the coast of this part of Alaska in order to allow for an easy access way for transportation that would be shipping stuff like non-renewable resources, you know, coal and oil from Alaska to other locations. Also would include another explosion that would dig out an ocean trench way to connect the harbor to the actual ocean. So the rumors were true. It was absolutely what the Atomic Energy Commission was planning on doing. And so the natives began to protest this and to ask for more information. Meanwhile, the government was actually getting a little bit of local support, particularly from the media in Alaska, but financial leaders were not so quick to jump on board. They were starting to ask very difficult questions like, obviously, the development of a nuclear explosive is an expensive endeavor. It's not like these things are cheap to create, especially the whole R&D process of making sure whatever casing you create actually gives you the effect you need. I mean, obviously, you're not just hoping that an uncontrolled explosion is going to do what you want it to do. You have to design the device so it directs the energy in the proper way, right? It can't just go outward in all directions equally. If you want to do a specific task.
Not for most tasks.
Right.
So the idea being to build a kind of rifle barrel for a nuke.
Or, yeah, some sort of device where it directs the explosion initially in the way that whatever your intended outcome is is the one that's most likely to happen. Keeping in mind
like a bottle rocket instead of a...
Yeah, instead of just like a pile of gunpowder.
Yeah.
Right? Which obviously doesn't explode, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
So the people who are in the financial world in this part of Alaska were saying, I don't know that this makes any more sense than conventional methods of excavation. It may very well be that we could just use normal construction and save money mm-hmm. and also not put anything at risk.
Sure. Well, and furthermore, one of the other arguments was that, you know, no one was sure at that point whether the resources that they were looking for in that area of Alaska were present.
Yeah, or at least not present in numbers worth, you know,
digging out,
doing all that work. Yeah, if you're talking about a multi-million dollar risky endeavor, and there's no guarantee that the resources you would be able to ship are actually in that part of Alaska, at least in numbers worthy of, you know, this kind of work, it becomes a question of, hey, what's the return on investment? Forget the fallout issue. Forget the radiation issue. If it doesn't make financial sense, why would we support this?
Yeah.
And in fact, this led to the Atomic Energy Commission changing its proposal in June of 1959. Because they could not find a customer for the harbor. The folks in Alaska were saying, like, even if you put it here, it's not really useful.
We're not really going to use it.
We're not there.
For shipping.
And the stuff might not be there. And then, of course, there were also the other protesters who were saying, we don't know how this is going to affect the environment. We don't know how it's going to affect the wildlife. We don't know how it's going to affect the people who live 30 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And without any of that knowledge, how can you go forward? And thus the AEC comes up with a brilliant idea of reframing this as an experiment to see what a nuclear explosive could do with the geophysical, environmental, and health impacts in the area. So including health impacts on human beings. In other words, the concerns that people had about the environment and health impact, that became the focus now. Like, we're worried about what this will do. So, you know what? That's a good idea. Let's find out what it will do.
Sounds like some Maleficent momentum.
Well, and it gets a little worse, really. In March 1960, the Atomic Energy Commission sent representatives to Point Hope to talk to the natives there and address concerns. And
by address concerns, you mean?
Lie. Yeah, they lied. Or at least they stretched the truth. No, they lied. I can't get around this. Like, you would have to be overly generous to say they stretched the truth. According to a report filed by Don Charles Foote, who was a geographer who actually was present, he filed a report with the Atomic Energy Commission. And his report actually contains this quote. It says that there would not be, quote, any danger to anyone. This is what the representatives were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Any danger to anyone if the fish were utilized, that the effects of nuclear weapons testing never injured any people, that's a lie, anywhere, that once the severely exposed Japanese people recovered from radiation sickness, there were no side effects,
ooh,
also a lie,
ooh,
that the residents of Point Hope would not feel any seismic shock at all from Project Chariot, and that copies of the environmental program studies would be made immediately available to the Point Hope Council upon the return of the AEC officials to California. The village council unanimously voted to oppose the detonation. You could say
good
they were
them.
Skeptical of the AEC representatives.
Yeah.
So ultimately, the AEC canceled this particular part of Project Plowshare in 1962. The Plowshare overall continued. That wasn't like the beginning and end. That was one project under this umbrella operation. So other proposals besides using it for excavation, and there were lots of excavation proposals for canals and that sort of stuff included. There was one that was a sea level canal across Panama. That was one of the proposals that was left, but they were never actually developed into actual projects. There were other ones too, not just digging canals. There was also tunneling. That was mm-hmm. a possibility. Blowing up holes in the sides of mountains and stuff.
Yeah. You know, if you need a road to go somewhere and there's a pesky mountain in the way,
yeah,
then why not use a nuclear bomb to just blow
a hole
in the mountain?
Yeah. I can't think of any reason why you wouldn't want to.
I mean,
that.
It would probably work.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
you definitely make an impact. That's for certain.
I mean, think of the gas mileage you would save on alone by not having to make cars go all the way up a mountain and all the way back down.
Right, right. Yeah, you've sold me. And another potential use was using nuclear explosions for underground engineering, which is similar to tunneling, but in this case specifically, with the goal of increasing permeability and porosity of rocks through breaking and fracturing them.
Oh, this is like accessing tight gas and stuff like
Yes. that. Yes. Yeah. So if you were to discover that there's a deposit of natural gas, but the rock that is between you and the natural gas is not particularly permeable or porous, it is very difficult to get at the natural gas.
Yeah. This is like nuclear fracking, basically. Yeah. Like it's saying that if you just break up that pesky rock with a nuclear explosion, then you can extract the stuff inside it that you want.
Dude, yes. with all the opposition people have to fracking, can you imagine what it would be if they were saying, we're going to use some nuclear bombs?
I honestly cannot.
Yeah.
That is literally beyond my imagination.
I
deal with people on the internet every day.
I like that they called it gas production stimulation.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much what people say about fracking, right?
Yeah.
You want to stimulate the well. I mean, the problem is, people have this idea that when you're accessing oil or natural gas, it's always just going to be like a big lake underground. You can just stick a straw in it. But instead it's locked up in porous rocks, and sometimes it's hard to get at.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that this became the most promising of all the proposed uses of nuclear bombs during the testing phase. Mm-hmm. None of it was ever actively incorporated into a civilian use or anything along those lines. But there were a lot of tests that were part of the Operation Plowshare. And out of all of them, the excavation stuff was not nearly as promising as the gas production stimulation.
The nuclear fracking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Another idea that was floated, at the very least in the video, was the thought that these explosions would be creating huge numbers of the radioactive isotopes that were being used in science.
Yeah. We're short on isotopes. Blow up another bomb.
Well, I mean, that is
it's not
sort
untrue.
Of interesting. We certainly have made an impact on the chemical signature of the surface of the Earth since the advent of the atomic age, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Like we've introduced things to planet Earth that you wouldn't expect to find in nature.
Oh, yeah. And there are some really scientifically interesting results of the sheer amount of atmospheric nuclear testing that were done back in these sorts of times, because every single thing on this planet that's carbon-based has enough of this nuclear fallout in their cellular systems that you can put a pretty accurate date on how old the cells in like your body are.
Yeah, it actually ends up.
So that's cool.
Actually ends up being something you have to take into account when you're carbon dating something.
Yeah. We've screwed up carbon dating forever, guys.
Yeah.
Good luck, future generations.
If you happen to know the general era, and you're just trying to narrow things down a bit, you can account for it. But otherwise,
if we go through a major dark age and then there's a resurgence and there are like future paleontologists trying to understand things, it's going to be really confusing.
Oh,
that's why I just leave random things around just in case, you know, so that way I can really confuse the future paleontologists. It's like, here's where they kept their ovens in the middle of this field for some reason. I just like doing that.
That was the field where we test nuclear cooking.
Right. Yes. As opposed to the nuclear, great refrigerator graveyard from all the failed delivery tests. you might be curious, like, did they actually detonate any nuclear bombs as part of Operation Plowshare? And the answer
is, I'm curious.
They did a lot. Yeah. Quite a few. Technically, they had 27 nuclear explosive tests with 35 individual detonations, because some tests had multiple detonations as part of the test. For example, when they were talking about doing the harbor excavation, they were thinking about doing two different detonations at one point, one for carving out the harbor and one for carving that trench to the ocean. And tests were mainly conducted at the Nevada test site. So we're not talking about going out into the field and testing it there for most of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this was an area that had already been designated. Like, this is where we test these things.
It wasn't like they were down in, like, the Everglades in Florida, like trying to dig out canals there with these things
teaching
I'm personally aware of.
Teaching alligators to rock it off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that would explain a lot about Florida having grown up there.
Well, so wait, we're talking about this in the past tense. When did this stop?
1975.
Okay.
Yeah. So 1975 was when it stopped. I'll talk a little more about what happened with that. But, some of the projects that were codenamed, like, you know, we had Chariot earlier, but at the Nevada test site, you had, projects named things like Sedan, Click-a-Tat,
what?
Handcar.
Handcar.
Sulky. That's my favorite, the Sulky. Templar, which is a close second.
Did they have
second.
A handsome cab?
They did not. They did have some other ones that were kind of similar. They also had Vulcan, Project Vulcan. These were all nuclear tests at the Nevada test site, but they also had non-nuclear tests. In other words, high explosive tests using conventional explosives to sort of measure the difference between the two, kind of get an idea of explosive design so that you could, again, get the effect that you really wanted. And those included project names like Toboggan, Hobo, Stagecoach, and Scooter. Meanwhile, Plowshare also had other projects. One was called Project Gnome, which was a test of underground explosives that took place in Carlsbad, New Mexico.
I play a gnome in D&D in the game that I'm currently playing. So that was what that giggle was.
Does your gnome have an explosive temper?
She does.
Well, she could very well fit in with Project Plowshare. She could just be.
She would actually totally approve of that. Yeah. She doesn't hold very high regard for life.
That,
how much are gnomes in D&D like David the Gnome?
Very little. I would say that David the Gnome was closer to what D&D would consider a halfling.
Ah, okay.
That's fair.
We can proceed.
Thank you, Joe, for allowing me to continue the show. So Project Gnome was going to be a 3 kiloton test in an underground salt bed deposit. Now, the main purpose of that one was to study isotope and energy production from an explosion to better understand how nuclear explosions might be used for peaceful purposes. So a lot of these tests weren't, let's just see if we can dig a canal. It was really examining this release of energy and figuring out how best to put it to use. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, I know we're being a little cavalier with the description of the program, but they really were trying to understand this from a scientific perspective.
I hope that we're not putting off the concept in any way that, you know, it's just a bunch of kids going outside and being like, yeah, let's see what happens if we explode one over there.
Hey, y'all, I got some M80s. Let's go put them in the trash can.
Yeah.
That's my youth. All right. So there were also nuclear tests near Grand Valley, Colorado and Farmington, New Mexico. And the final detonation, you know, I said that the program ended in 1975, but the final detonation actually happened in May 1973. It's called Rio Blanco. And it was a 3-explosive test with each explosive at 33 kilotons. And it was a natural gas stimulation experiment near Rifle, Colorado. And kilotons, by the way, when we say kiloton and megaton, in case you don't know, that's the equivalent amount of TNT. Mm-hmm. That would create a similar explosion. So obviously, one of the big advantages of a nuclear explosion is you have a much smaller compact package in the explosive device than you would if you had to use a comparable amount of TNT.
Man, yeah, it is a pain to ship thousands of kilotons of TNT to a test site in the desert.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're using it to actually do something like you really want to dig a canal and you're figuring out, oh, we're going to need 10,000 tons of TNT to do this, or we could use one 10 kiloton nuclear bomb, then you're like, well, I can see where the practical side comes in.
It's like building a better battery out of radioactive material that will mess up your world for generations to come.
Now,
you know, we make a lot of jokes as if it's just kind of ridiculous to think that nuclear explosions could be used for any purpose other than warfare or weaponry. But I don't know if that actually is a ridiculous idea, because I think there are perhaps some cases we can think of where we would want a ton of energy released very quick for a non-killing purpose.
Sure. And to be fair, there was a lot of research into how to create a nuclear explosion and control the issue of fallout, so that you don't have an ongoing problem that continues well after the explosion.
Yeah, that seems like one of the biggest drawbacks.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Well, and also, you know, to put all of this a little bit into perspective, it wasn't until the 1990s that wartime nuclear testing was discontinued in many countries. And I mean, North Korea is still doing it today.
Yeah,
so.
There was a moratorium that happened briefly at the very beginning of Operation Plowshare, like right in 1961, mm-hmm. but it ended in 1960. It might have even been late 1961 or early 1962 when the Soviet Union started doing underground tests and the U.S. said, all right, game's on.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and furthermore, I don't think it was until the first decade of the 2000s that we started really getting reports back on exactly how damaging even that kind of testing can be.
Yeah, we didn't have the science. I mean, there was no way of knowing, right?
Yeah.
That's the kind of knowledge that you gain only through the passage of time. And that's unfortunate if it's a negative impact in the case of fallout. That's obviously the case. Well, by the early 1970s, it was pretty clear to the U.S. government that Plowshare was not going to be able to continue. It was not receiving very much support, certainly not from the public and also not from politicians. And since it's a government agency and it gets its money from the government, that translated into a lack of funds, which meant that projects were getting canceled. Like some of the projects that had been planned never went through, not because anyone protested them, but because there was not enough money to actually do them in the first place. So by 1975, the program was completely discontinued. Also, the Atomic Energy Commission dissolved by the end of 1975. So the interesting thing to me is that the idea, and you were kind of alluding to this, Joe, the idea of using nuclear explosions to do constructive work in some way, or at least to do non-weapon work in some way, isn't gone. There's still suggestions that help pop up today.
Now, I bet some of these suggestions are still stupid.
Yeah, some of them, or at least some of them, are met with critical skepticism, let us say.
I bet you have an example.
I do. And there were some that I didn't include in this layout that we could have talked about, like the idea of using nuclear explosions to propel a spacecraft into space. I think we may have mentioned that in a previous episode.
Yeah, we have.
We're really looking at other stuff here. Like, in 2010, there was a CNN reporter, named John Roberts, who was covering the, British Petroleum Deepwater Horizon crisis. You guys remember that, obviously, right?
Oh, yeah.
Offshore oil drill that you know, there was a terrible failure and we were having oil just leak into the ocean, and it was just
directly from the well itself.
And it was a huge PR disaster for BP, as well as a true environmental disaster. So John Roberts at one point, kind of in an offhand way and not necessarily in a serious way, said, drill a hole, drop a nuke, and seal up the well. So use a nuclear explosion to collapse the well in on itself and thus stop the oil from leaking into the ocean. there was some opposition to this proposal. Critics pointed out that there were a few issues. There was one that you couldn't really be sure that this wouldn't make things worse. Like it wouldn't just open the well up even more and create an even greater problem that would be harder to fix. Environmentally, no one was really sure how that might impact the area, the ecosystem. And keep in mind,
the explosion and also the residual radioactivity.
Yeah. And ecosystems are connected to other ecosystems, right? It's not like an ecosystem is a self-contained static environment that nothing ever enters into or leaves. So
unless you're talking about maybe like a terrarium.
Yeah. Or maybe an entire, like if you're looking at a global ecosystem.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. The global ecosystem is pretty well contained.
Yeah. You don't tend to see like dolphins fly off into space except in Douglas Adams novels.
Right.
So at any rate, people were saying, you know, this, we don't know what could happen as a result of this, either from technical or health standard. It would be monumentally short-sighted to try this approach. And also politically, this was during a time when President Barack Obama was arguing for global nuclear disarmament. So to say like, hey, everyone needs to get rid of their nuclear bombs, by the way, we're totally going to use one right now. that's probably not the most prudent political approach. And also, there have been a lot of treaties about the use of nuclear weapons. that mostly say, hey, don't do it. So that would also be an issue. So people were essentially saying it's practically,
wait,
politically,
you said
technically.
Mostly? Do some of the treaties say, don't do it unless you're real mad?
You know, I hate to speak in absolutes.
Okay.
I like to give myself wiggle room just in case somewhere in tiny little print, there's like, okay, if you super pinky swear that it's not for destructive uses,
well,
you can totally
go
ahead.
I mean, if someone pulls out your controller cord when you're playing Super Mario Brothers,
that is justification for nuclear attack. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with that. I, you know, at any rate,
these problems are best solved by a cup of Mountain Dew to the face.
That's one example of someone suggesting using nuclear explosions for something other than as a weapon.
Surely there's a more interesting one than that.
There's one that was very recent. It was back in 2015 when Elon Musk, one of our favorite folks to talk about on the podcast,
yeah.
He was on an appearance of at the Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And in the midst of a discussion, conversation turned toward Mars, as it always does. And Musk kind of casually said that one way we could try and terraform Mars is by detonating some nuclear bombs over the poles. Colbert's response was, "You're talking like a supervillain. This is what supervillains say."
Which was not inaccurate.
Yeah, it's not incorrect. Yeah. He later clarified that he wasn't talking about like dropping a bomb on the pole, but rather detonating them above the poles in the Martian atmosphere, which is already pretty thin. The idea being that using fusion-based nuclear weaponry, you could create miniature pulsing stars, and you'd have to do a series of these explosions to continue having a star present at the poles, but these stars would heat up the planet enough to melt some of the frozen carbon dioxide to turn it into gas form.
Mm-hmm.
Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, so if you flooded the Martian atmosphere with greenhouse gas, then, at least in theory, it would trap some of that heat and help the planet go on a warming trend.
Oh, yeah, like a relatively rapid climate change sort of trend towards something more habitable.
But, they also said that, you know, after a century or so, you would probably have safe levels of radiation around the polar regions. Just within a century, you would be able to actually put stuff there. But and at any rate,
it kind of makes sense because terraforming is a many, many years project anyway. It's not like you'd start it one year and move in 3 years later.
Look, I saw Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan and the Genesis Project. Uh-huh. I know that it only takes a day. No, I agree with you entirely. So when we say rapid terraforming, we're talking obviously relatively so, because any other approach would take much more time.
Yeah, right? Like only a couple centuries rather than a couple of millennia.
There are people who have maybe not dismissed this idea, but at least expressed concern about such an approach. James Lewis Center for Strategic and International Studies said that any idea that sounds like a scene from a Schwarzenegger movie is open to question, which is fairly comedic, but there were more specifics. Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, said that a nuclear explosion could force a lot of particles up into the atmosphere that would block sunlight from reaching the surface of Mars, from penetrating the atmosphere.
Right. This is the old nuclear winter hypothesis.
Exactly. So,
right, which is the opposite of warming a planet up.
Exactly so. So you would end up either preserving or making Mars even colder than it already is. You make it even more difficult for you to achieve the goal of terraforming it. That is a possible outcome. And others pointed out that it also might be a little premature to talk about terraforming another planet when we still haven't figured out how to take care of the one we're on.
Well, I don't know. That sounds like whataboutism.
Maybe.
I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't figure out how to take care of the one we're on, but it's not an either or.
Well, I think it's more along the lines of how can we be sure we can fix the problems of another planet when we haven't been able to fix the problems that we're on now? Right. So the idea being that,
well, when's that tipping point? Yeah. Like there's too many problems here.
Well,
those other problems are way more fun to work on. Let's just go there.
Plus, if we screw up, there aren't any people there, So
that we know of.
Yeah.
Now, well, that is one thing I would propose is it's possible that before we start terraforming Mars, we need to spend more time looking for signs of life and previous life on Mars to
right.
make sure that we don't erase evidence of the most interesting thing we might find in the interstellar system.
That was another argument that other scientists were proposing as well, saying,
yeah, like if we could
kill whatever is left there.
Yeah. If we're trying, I mean, like if it's to the point where we're trying not to like make rovers move so fast that they'll upset the Martian dust.
Yeah.
Then probably a nuclear explosion in the atmosphere
might be a bit much.
Yeah.
It would also cause an EMP surge that could destroy Martian technology. I mean, how are we supposed to find that Martian time machine and leave it working?
All those Martian soap operas will go off the air.
Oh, no.
Well, and more seriously, I mean, we've already talked about in previous episodes the difficulty in figuring out whether or not there are any signs of life on Mars because of the chance that we could ourselves contaminate the samples
mm-hmm.
just by bringing along microbes from Earth that then could be interpreted as being a microbe from Mars. In fact, it was just a hitchhiker the whole time. If we drop a couple of nuclear bombs in some areas on Mars, there's a good chance that we could eliminate any possibility of finding anything. And then we're even more uncertain in the future when we send rovers or other devices to the planet to look for signs of life. If, in fact, that was there already or if we brought it there accidentally.
Nuke it from orbit. It's the only way to be sure.
On the positive side, something like that would absolutely kill off the Mars One project.
Yeah.
For sure. And I would be real excited about that.
We wouldn't have to wait for a reality TV show to fail. I am 99% confident that is not going to go anywhere. I, from what I understand, they are well behind any of their fundraising goals.
Weird.
Yeah. Odd that people aren't lining up to pay for what seems like a practically impossible project.
I think you guys, we found the two things that I feel like real comfortable being snarky about on air, and that's casual use of nuclear weapons and Mars One.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that we got to talk about them both in the same episode.
Yeah. And of course, like I said, there were other potential uses for nuclear explosions that we're not covering.
Like the idea of nuclear propulsion for spacecraft. I think this is not something that is completely off the table for future use.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
There have been designs in the past, like Project Orion was a proposal for nuclear thrust propelled spacecraft. So you detonate a nuclear device and then you would capture that energy, and with I think there have been different kinds of designs. Some involved like a spacecraft with a slingshotting kind of back and forth motion with a parachute that would catch the explosion.
And then
there are other designs too. But yeah, it seems like that could be a very interesting option, especially if you're talking about a very long mission that you want to accelerate to very fast speeds to shorten the length of the trip.
Right. Obviously,
it doesn't make sense if you're going to the moon, but it might make sense if you're trying to go to Saturn.
Yeah, it does cause people to voice concern, and legitimately so, about what happens in the event of a launch failure and you happen to have what is equivalent to a nuclear bomb on board that rocket that would otherwise be launching into space. And that's one of those things that people have brought up as an objection to this kind of approach.
I think quite obviously the solution is we build our nuke production facility in orbit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that we're making the bombs in a space station.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Because blowing up the space station is basically okay. Blowing up Cape Canaveral would suck.
I don't mean the space station like the ISS. I mean like a fully automated space station.
This is reminding me of a terrible Asylum movie I watched called The Terminators, and so I'm having flashbacks to that. So I'm going to wrap this up.
Okay, fair enough.
It was a really interesting kind of way of looking back at what was, I would argue, an optimistic, even set aside the cynical the underbelly of whatever the motivations might have been. It was an optimistic view of what can we do with this technology that isn't destructive. Let's try and find a way of making use of this in a way that's not about ending the lives of thousands of people. And I like that, even if ultimately it was not a fruitful effort.
You know, another thing that does occur to me in terms of peaceful uses of nuclear weapons, weapon right there in the title, peaceful uses of nuclear explosions.
Yeah.
Would be that might become a more useful thing once our society grows to something more like the next level of the Kardashev scale. Because when you're talking about the surface of the Earth, there are just not many things that you need that much energy that fast for, especially with all the risks associated. But when you're, when you're talking about engineering gigantic projects in space, then I can maybe see more what's going on. Maybe stellar engineering or planetary engineering on dead planets.
If we want to get all the elements in place for our own Dyson sphere, then we're going to be...
Nukes might be useful.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I can see where Elon Musk is going with this.
Yeah. I mean, I can definitely understand the critics as well, but... If we can find ways of making responsible use of this possible, where we have minimized risk and we have maximized return, then I don't necessarily have an objection to it, apart from my initial emotional reaction, which is always going to be, please don't. That's always going to be my initial emotional reaction to this, partly because I grew up during the Cold War. So, it's one of those things that's kind of deeply ingrained in my brain, but maybe one day we will figure it out and be able to put it to use in a way that no one really has, a credible objection to. Time will tell. But, something I want you guys out there to think about is, hey, you got ideas for episodes that we should cover here on Forward Thinking, like topics for our episodes
or ways that we could use nuclear weapons and peaceful
sure if you're like, you know, I like that fried chicken idea,
whatever, yeah,
you'd let us know. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or you can drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook. At Twitter we are fwthinking, and on Facebook just search fwthinking. We will pop up in the search results. You can leave us a message there. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.